The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. We have a lot to share today. I'm going to be offering two short commentaries, one by Danny Schechter from The Liquidation of Bin Laden, a Military or a Media Operation. Nailing Bin Laden, was it a military media operation? Why now? And then from Joanne Harry, Can We Now Learn the Real Lesson of Bin Laden's Death? From HuffingtonPost.com. And I will be interspersing my own commentary that I wrote last night on into both of these. Following that, I would like you to call in and share your points of view. And I'll take as many of those calls as possible. Our guest in the second part of our program today will be Kurt Spellmeyer. And we're going to talk about Buddha at the Apocalypse, meaning awakening from a culture of destruction. I just don't think the average American is clear or focused upon what it means to make a choice that can only lead to destruction and retribution, an eye for an eye, or one that comes from a more spiritual text that tackles the social, political, and environmental issues in a spiritual perspective. We have no one anywhere doing that today in our government, and hence we shouldn't be surprised at the reaction from around the world and what's happening to our own citizens. But we're going to give you the positive look for those of you who choose to make a more dynamic stance and to make some sacrifice, to go to the streets, to go to the phones, and to protest what you feel strongly about and not just sit passively back, as the majority of people unfortunately do, both on the left and the right. The latest, of course, on health and healing. I'm going to begin with a question that I was given about an hour ago from my office. I'm on the road filming, and it was about someone who keeps getting infections, and so they spend a lot of time cleaning in their toilet thinking that's the cause of the infections. Well, in point of fact, it is not. The dirtiest part of the vast majority of people's homes is their kitchen, not their toilet. And in the kitchen, the three dirtiest things you can possibly do, which will contribute to bacteria, parasites, and disease, sponges. People forget how many times you use a sponge to clean something that's dirty, and then, well, let me just make it so everybody will understand what I'm saying. The next time you use the bathroom and you use toilet paper, don't flush it, save it. And, you know, you get sweaty, wipe your forehead with it. You have to blow your nose, use it, but don't throw it away. And next time you have to go to the bathroom, use it again, and again, and again, and again. And that might get you the idea of what happens every time you use a sponge and you don't clean it. Oh, dude, you mean you got to clean that sponge? I didn't know. Yeah, I'm sure you didn't know. Yeah, you're probably the person that turns around underwear inside, outside, thinking, why wash it when I can just keep reversing it? Some of your sheets are so stiff you could probably just stand them in a corner. It's called hygiene. Boy, do we have a problem with hygiene in the United States. We just don't look at the basics. The sponge in your kitchen is the single most toxic place in your home. It is what's going to cause problems, because think of all the things you wipe with that sponge. How about forks and spoons and cups and bowls? You've just spread all over that product everything that was on the sponge. And then the countertop is the second place that is contaminated. Then the doorknobs to your refrigerator are the third place. And then the handle to the spigot is the fourth. And the sink is the fifth. What, you mean you got to clean a sink? Yeah. Well, how do you do that? Well, there are a couple ways. If you want the really absolutely guaranteed way to kill everything that's in the sink and on the countertop, you take a small amount of diluted, you can use alcohol, but and hydrogen peroxide combined, or you can use small amount of bleach, about 20 to 1, water, 20, bleach, 1, use a little mask, and then wipe it down. That will kill everything. Here's something people don't realize. When you use alcohol, if you don't scrub what you've used alcohol, it will not get rid of the actual contaminant. It will simply lower its bacterial count. So that's what you got to do. You got to really scrub. And then throw your sponge into the washing machine when you do your wash, and that helps clean it. Simple. And sponges are so inexpensive, but you got to clean it every time you use it. Next up, this is from people who should have learned this lesson and didn't and died because of it. This is from the Times of India. Quote, millions of patients admitted to hospitals in this country could recover faster if healthcare workers follow proper hand washing routines, which helps to avoid hospital acquired infections. These infections, by the way, are known as healthcare acquired infections, or HCAI. They're going to result in a longer stay. They're going to cause long-term disability. They're going to cause 100,000 people just in the United States last year to die. Why? Because you're really bright, genius, close-to-God surgeon? No, forgot to wash his hands. Nurse? Same thing. Didn't get under the fingernails. Orderly? Forget about it. Probably washed their hands in a toilet bowl. As a result, you died. Someone you know died. 100,000 Americans died. Put that in perspective. If we had 100,000 Americans dying of 1 year of something that was preventable, wouldn't you think someone would get concerned? Someone would say, let's stop? No, not in our system. So every year we just keep killing about 100,000 Americans because of dirty hands, lack of hygiene, not cleaning under the fingernails, and then not sterilizing a hospital room when you go into it. You think they've sterilized it? I could go into any hospital in the United States, no exceptions, not one exception, and I could find you enough bacteria in there to kill an elephant. If I were going into a hospital, I would personally have, if I was physically incapable, I would have someone go in there and disinfect the room, because every surface that you touch is going to be contaminated. They just do a superficial job. We should be putting real good air filters in. We should have a backup unit, and we should sterilize a lot of the equipment using ozone. That's better than autoclaving it, but we don't. As a result, something as simple as clean hands kill. Quote, in India, about 50% of healthcare workers are unaware. That means doctors, nurses are unaware about proper techniques for cleaning their hands. This is according to the World Hygiene Council. Quote, 70% of the general population are also not aware of this aspect. So you got 50% of doctors, nurses, and orderlies and others in a hospital unaware they should be cleaning their hands, and 70% of the population unaware. Well, that's a perfect formula for someone getting really some serious bacteria and viruses and parasites into their system. Hygiene 101. If you defecate, wash. If you wipe, you just smear the contaminants. Why do we have a problem? In France, they actually have a bidet. In America, if you put a bidet, someone thinks it's a little doggy water fountain. It isn't. It's to clean thoroughly with soap and water. And by the way, you don't need the antibacterial soaps. Just regular old soap and water and scrubbing is just as effective without any possible downside that some of the artificial ingredients in and the artificial chemicals in those antibacterial soaps will give you. So hopefully we got this right. And always wash every food that you eat. I see all the time in the stores I'm getting my juices in the morning to start my day. I'll see people coming in and, oh, the fresh crates 7 days a week come in. And you'll see the cherries and strawberries and blueberries. And people go over and start picking and eating. So I go over and I say, excuse me, why don't you have a gentleman behind the counter wash that? Well, it's organic. Yeah. How many hands touched this that weren't clean? And whatever's on their hands is now on the berry and it's now in your body. Do you want to be sharing your DNA, fecal DNA? You might as well pull the blueberry out of someone's butt and eat it, because that's what happens when you just eat something without washing it. Because I can promise you, the vast majority of everything we eat touched by a minimum of 12 and as many as 24 separate human beings' hands are contaminating it. So wash all your fruits and nuts, and wash the vegetables, and when you wash lettuce, wash it thoroughly. Wash it and massage it as you're washing it, because the little creases on the leafy vegetable is where the bacteria and parasites in the organic matter. Yes, you want organic, but remember, organic means manure. And when it's being irrigated, the water hits the ground, and the ground then bounces back up onto the product. And when the product grows, like a head of lettuce will grow, and it'll another leaf grows and another leaf grows, and they start to combine, and whatever was in that earlier contaminated leaf stays there. It's just like celery. When you cut the bottom of celery off, wash thoroughly each stalk. Then it's great for you. If you only knew how many people are contaminated, let me just give you a basic figure. And these are probably conservative by 30%. Over 100 million cases of food poisoning each year in the United States. And thousands are going to end up with someone dying. And especially in the summertime, where they forget how toxic it is to leave something out in the sun. And water contamination, tens of millions of people adversely affected by parasites and pollutants in the water. Proper hygiene. Next up, black rice bran reduces inflammation. Now, almost all illnesses have inflammation as a part of it. So by turning off inflammatory reactions in the body, it's the first stage of starting the healing process. I don't care how many people I'm working with or what their conditions, the very first thing I do as a protocol is turn off inflammation in the body. Get rid of local infections. So then you can focus the full power of the body's healing on the major, whatever it is, tumor, clogged arteries. Well, a new study has shown that black rice, which, by the way, is little known in the United States, but easy to find, and it's a staple for one-third of the world's population, can turn off inflammation in the body. That can help you with allergies, asthma, and other diseases. Mendel Freeman and colleagues at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Western Research Center in Albany, California, did the research, and what they found was that this is a very good product, much better than white rice, because it has a lot of the nutrients. So you want black rice or black rice bran. Both are good for you. Both are anti-inflammatory. Let's say you're a person getting some radiation, or let's say you've already been exposed to some radiation. And by the way, I have new information based upon my recent travels and filming, very recent and very documented, that shows that I'm going to guesstimate right now that virtually all the information we're receiving about radiation in the United States from Japan is grossly conservative, way lower than what we're actually getting. And the people in Japan, you probably right now have about 3 million Japanese who have very high levels of radiation in their body, but the trouble is they won't know it for a while, maybe 2, 5, 10, 20 years. Then they'll start seeing the leukemias, the cancers, defects in organ systems. The government over there has just been criminal, absolutely criminal, in lying to their public. And unfortunately, no one will be held accountable. There may be at some point some resignation or some apology, but only after they've been forced to do so. But you're going to see an epidemic in Japanese children having leukemias and cancers in the next 10 years. The radiation over there was far worse than what anyone was told. I won't go any further in it. I will save that for a special in-depth original investigative report coming at you shortly. So anyhow, there's something that will help fight radiation sickness is the grapes, nuts, and red wine. That's right. This is the newest study from the American Cancer Society Medicinal Chemistry Letters, and here's what it says, quote, scientists have found that an antioxidant found in red wine, grapes, and nuts, a substance similar to resveratrol, by the way, that is resveratrol. Some people ask, well, how's it spelled? Just phonetically, it's res, R-E-S, ver, V-E-R, atrol, A-T-R-O-L, resveratrol. It could prevent, quote, radiation sickness. Now, this is a major finding, given the ongoing concern about radiation exposure at the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan, but also around nuclear facilities in the United States. And the researchers studied whether resveratrol, which is a natural and healthful antioxidant found in many foods, could protect against radiation injuries. And they found that resveratrol protects cells, and that is important. So, one more thing to add, and finally, the fruit juice cocktail that cuts heart disease risks. Some French scientists have created a cocktail of 7 fruit juices that could help lower the risk of heart disease and stroke, and it also tastes good. Now, here is what the French have come up with, and this is being heralded all over the place, a lot of articles all over there. You know, the super smoothie. Wow. What's it contain? Something clearly that we're not aware of. Something revolutionary. Blueberries, strawberries, grapes, and apples. Well, they're saying these are all superfoods. Oh, they added in the cowberry. Well, actually, the cowberry is the lingonberry. It's tart red fruit. It's related to the cranberry and acerola. So, but it's 30 times more vitamin C than orange juice. And the final ingredient in the smoothie was aronia. A-R-O-N-I-A. It's also called chokeberry. It's an American blackberry, once described as the healthiest berry in the world. Now, who in this audience can tell me where you've got aronia? Read your labels. There's only one product out there that I'm aware of that has aronia. And I'll bet some of you are using it. Well, this is a major discovery for these people. Some of you have been using this for about 15, 20, 25 years. But I'm glad that it's getting this, because this is what I've been telling you all along. When an official establishment source says something, then it's suddenly legitimate. Anyone who's not in that circle of being a power person, then it's not given relevance. So they put in the apple, the acerola, the grape, the aronia, the blueberry, strawberry. And this was published in the Royal Society of Chemistry, the Journal of Food and Function. So good for them. I'm sure a lot of people start using this, and I'm happy about that. But wow, could they have been 25 years ahead of where they're at had they just did a little differently? Now, to a commentary, and if we time permits, a call or two. From Danny Schechter. I'll quote this from opednews.com. The tip on bin Laden's whereabouts came back in 2010. You have to assume the house was under surveillance. If they thought they bagged him, they would be watching closely and choosing the right time to deep six the target. The CIA maintained a safe house, quote, in the Pakistani city where bin Laden was, for a small team of spies who conducted extensive surveillance over a period of months on the compound where Osama bin Laden was killed by U.S. Special Operations Forces this week, unquote. That's U.S. official. Well, both Afghan agents and Pakistani intelligence now say they told the U.S. about the house where Osama bin Laden was in 2001. So they knew he was there. That was the reason drones weren't used. The CIA wanted a more controlled, high-profile, dramatic intervention for public consumption, for what in the end was a marketing campaign, marketing the centrality of the agency's role in a war whose main audience is not on the battlefield but in the homeland. They needed a heroic narrative to revive support for war they had been losing, and a scalp to sell to a conflict-wary and disillusioned population. So it's no surprise that the Navy SEALs labeled this Geronimo, reviving memories of fighting guerrilla-style Indian wars. Muslim renegades are apparently our new savages. The Native Americans took their enemy's head and hair. Well, we take out their eyes and waterboard their brains. The target was not the terror mastermind, but the American people. It was an exercise in political mobilization and perception management. It was the ultimate media operation, relying on many of the tactics used in Iraq that I documented in my film, Weapons of Mass Deception. We are as conscious about what we say as what we do. We always fashion a propaganda storyline demonizing the enemy, who is often compared to Hitler. Bin Laden lived in a million-dollar mansion, we were told. Well, no, it cost $48,000. He was heavily armed. No, he wasn't. He hid behind female human shields. No, he didn't. But who cares about the facts? This was a TV-orchestrated event. The Daily Mail in London complained that their raising questions led to them being derided as, quote, cheese-eating surrender monkeys. They could have captured him. But that would lead to the hassle of putting him on trial. Besides, what if he revealed his long connection with the CIA and U.S. officials? Can't have that. So the kill order was given, along with the quick disposal of the body, mafia style, as in Sleeping with the Fishes. The legal justification was self-defense, an argument that any government can use to dispatch its enemies. Why was it done and why now? It was certainly not because Al-Qaeda is ascendant. Our experts believe only 100 Al-Qaeda remain in Afghanistan, where their capacity has been diminished. Remember, Al-Qaeda is not a centralized top-down machine, but a decentralized, sophisticated network. We can only surmise all the factors, but the larger context here has fallen away with a focus on the narrowness of the dirty details. Many calculated to inspire enthusiasm for the bravery and heroism of the death squad, but not any reflection of the strategy and larger context of the events. Even as the cover stories about what happened fell away to the foggy soup of covert action and its contradictions, it devolved into a case of excuses about haste. He said that, but he didn't mean it. Even as the raids inspire mass euphoria and self-righteous bloodlust, the full meaning of it is missing in a media that is much better at how than why. First of all, this operation reflected the reorganization of the national security state, with the CIA taking over from the soldiers. This operation was Leon Panetta's last hurrah as spook in chief before he uses his co-op portfolio to take over the Pentagon as defense secretary. Second, that most hyped soldier, Generalissimo David Petraeus, who has failed in the insurgency in Afghanistan and is now warring in Pakistan, is being moved into Panetta's job at the CIA. A Navy SEAL commander has now been promoted to the Central Command. The bottom line, public accountability and open disclosure has become a thing of the past. No wonder the ongoing campaign to get WikiLeaks before it exposes more of our dirty secrets. As the military privatizes war and in effect goes underground, there is a recognition that despite the size of our forces and the power of our technology, we have in effect been losing to peasants with suicide belts and unconventional tactics we continually underestimate. Wright's former Assistant Treasury Secretary, who was on my program yesterday, Professor Paul Craig Roberts, quote, "Americans are too busy celebrating to think," a capability that seems to have been taken out of their education. Americans are so enthralled over the death of bin Laden that they do not wonder why information gleaned years ago would take so long to locate a person who was allegedly living in a million-dollar building equipped with all the latest communication equipment next to the Pakistani military academy. Allegedly, the most wanted criminal was not moving from hideout to hideout in desolate mountains, but ensconced in luxury quarters in broad daylight. Nevertheless, despite his obvious location, it took the CIA years to find him after claiming to have gained information of his whereabouts out of captives and secret prisons. This is the image of the CIA as the Keystone Cops. Well, like the Canadian Mounties in the end, Navy SEAL Team 6, armed with lethal weapons and an attack dog, got their man with not inconsiderable collateral damage in what the New York Times called an extremely one-sided encounter. It was, let's admit, a liquidation, right out of the KGB playbook. Politically, and yes, there was a political agenda here, too. The bin Laden operation was part of a chain of calculated presidential promotional exercises, including the announcement of his re-election campaign and massive fundraising effort. His deals with the Republicans on the budget, the release of the birth certificate, his interview with Oprah, his shakeup of all sorts at the Pentagon, his bringing the CEO of General Electric and William Daley into the White House, and on and on. The new Obama wants to be seen as a warrior, not a wuss, as long as he's not forced to go after Wall Street. Right now, his victory is viewed widely for what it is, vengeance, or in the words of the street, payback. Nailing bin Laden has to be seen in the context of his spring offensive, grounded in symbolic advances, to get his poll numbers up and his campaign rolling, to make him look invincible, and to triangulate by moving to the center and preempting, co-opting the right he now has, Bush and Cheney praising him. Concludes Roberts, quote, Obama needed closure of the Afghan war and occupation in order to deal with the U.S. budget deficit. Subsequent statements from Obama's regime officials suggest that the agenda might be to give Americans a piece of war victory in order to boost their lagging enthusiasm. The military security complex will become richer, more powerful, and Americans will be rewarded with vicarious pleasure in victory over enemies. As Tom Englehart consider, quote, It is an insult to irony, but the world bin Laden really changed forever wasn't in the greater Middle East. It was here. Cheer his death. Bury him at sea. Don't release any photos. And he still will carry as a ghost as long as Washington continues to fight its deadly, disastrous wars in his old neighborhood. Unquote. Those are the thoughts of him and one more here, and then I'll take your calls. And I'm going to give you our number to call in. It is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. This is from Joanne Harry, and it is called, Can We Now Learn the Real Lesson of Bin Laden's Death? And this is short. Scramble the film backwards. Rewind. Go back to the day 10 years ago when the air here in Manhattan was thick with ash and Osama bin Laden was gloating. There were two options for the United States government, to pick up a scalpel or pick up a blowtorch. With a scalpel, you go after the fundamentalist murderers responsible with patient policing and intelligence work and steadily drain them of their support. With a blowtorch, you invade a slew of countries with a great blubber bless of slaughter and torture and swell the army of enraged jihadists determined to kill. History branched in two possible directions that day. We know which Osama bin Laden preferred. He wanted to draw the West into endless bloody wars that hemorrhaged billions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of lives. He told his supporters, quote, We conducted a war of attrition against Russia for 10 years until they went bankrupt. We are continuing in the same policy to make America bleed profusely to the point of bankruptcy. We all have to do is send two mujahideen to a remote, irrelevant area and raise a piece of cloth on which it is written Al-Qaeda in order to make the U.S. generals race there, to cause America to suffer human, economic, and political losses. Unquote. He knew that every ramped-up attack would appear to vindicate his narrative about the evil West waging war on Islam and sway his army of recruits. When bin Laden's favorite son, Omar, defected, he told many unflattering stories about his father, including that he tortured his pets to death. So it is highly unlikely to be a double bluff when he explained that the day George Bush was elected, quote, my father was so happy. This is the kind of president he needs, one who will attack and spend money and break his own country. The West reacted to 9/11 by giving bin Laden precisely what he wanted. We tossed aside our best values, making them look like hollow charade. And every time we did it, more the number of jihadists grew. The detailed studies by terrorism expert Peter Bergen and others have found that the invasion of Iraq and the torture used there caused a 700% increase in jihadism globally. Yet last weekend we saw how it might have been. The operation wasn't perfect. Much rather bin Laden had been taken alive and put on trial rather than summarily executed. But it was a precise raid. It took real risks to minimize the deaths of civilians. It didn't use torture. Most people in the world can support an action like this. Now, your thoughts on this. Was this another October surprise of how Ronald Reagan beat Jimmy Carter by getting the prisoners released in Iran? If the CIA knew where bin Laden was and knew who his protectors were, didn't we have some more responsibility to let the American public know? That's their thoughts. I'd like to know yours. I'll take a moment before we take our break, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Your time to call in and share your points of view. And then when we come back from our break, we're going to be speaking with Kurt Spellmeyer, who teaches in the English department at Rutgers and is the director of the school's writing program. And he received Dharma transmission to be a Zen Roshi practitioner. We're going to talk about awakening from a culture of destruction. He will be a very interesting person to speak with. We have a flood of calls coming in. I'm only going to take a couple, so as soon as we get them up here, we will have you right on the air. And Sunday night, 8 o'clock, I'll be doing my Sunday evening commentary with calls on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. If you forget that, go to GaryNall.com and it takes it right over there. It's 8 o'clock live. Gordon from Douglaston, you're on the air.
Hiya, Gary. How are you today?
Doing great. Thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. Gary, this buffoon, Donald Trump, has missed a great opportunity to be demanding the pictures from Bin Laden. We have seen, sadly, JFK's brains blown out. We saw the people, sadly, jumping out of the World Trade Center. But the American people can't tolerate this. Trump, as a construction builder, should be demanding, why did that Tower 7 fall at 5 o'clock in the afternoon at the World Trade Center? And jet fuel that they're claiming melted the steel, steel melts at 2,000 degrees, and the jet fuel burns at 1,200 degrees. And that's my comment, and I thank you for your time.
Okay, well, I don't believe that Donald Trump is the person responsible enough to deal with this because, A, 70% of the American population just don't like him. He's not a very likable person. I do believe that what we need now is a completely independent commission of experts, physicists and investigators, people who have something constructive of prima facie evidence to come forward under oath and to present information so we have a new and legitimate 9/11 commission. That way we can at least bring evidence forward under oath and examine it, including exculpatory materials and materials that were intentionally withheld from the first one. I cannot tell you who did what. All I can tell you is the information presented is extremely inaccurate. So that is what is needed there. Separately, I believe that we should show bodies of dead Americans. I believe that we should interview people, as I did in a commentary from Chris Hedges, who have to go in and clean up the brains and the flesh and put them in bags. That's what got us out of Vietnam. That, watching this, when there wasn't censorship, where the reporters went in and weren't just embedded reporters, but they were really independent reporters and showed us the real face of war. Something the politicians could not disguise or manipulate. So when we saw the actual injuries, when we saw desperate soldiers trying to save their comrade's life and how tragic that was and the impact upon it, then we began to say, hold on a second, this is a real war. We have a sanitized war since then. We don't see the innocent children who are blown up by the drones. We don't see any of this. So I believe we have to see and be completely responsible for the consequences of our actions. Thank you very much. Peter from New Jersey, your last up. Peter, go ahead.
Yes, regarding radiation in Japan, they were doing tests on water supplies and so forth in various parts of the nation. I'm wondering why, did anybody check rainwater? I mean, wouldn't that be the most logical thing to do?
Yes,
check the
would.
Rainwater to see what the percentage and so forth, what the content was.
Well, in point of fact, virtually all major storms will have rainwater collected, depending upon if they're coming in off the West Coast. But the trouble is, when you have a certain level of radiation in the material, you either say that this is a dangerous amount, or you say you raise the standard of acceptable exposure. I remember they did this with DDT. First they said, well, DDT is not a problem. Then they said, well, it's not very widely distributed. Then when they did tests and found all these mothers had it in their breast milk, then they simply said, well, it's not that bad at that dose. Then when it got higher, they said, let's raise the dose. So three times they kept raising the dose of how much DDT was allowed in your body before they, the FDA, considered it dangerous. This is a game, and this is a deadly game. We shouldn't have any exposure to radiation in our water. So we have been lied to. From my recent travels, from my interviews, I can tell you we've been lied to nonstop.
Have you heard anything about anybody testing rainwater?
I have not.
No.
But I do believe they have tested it, and I believe that that's the last thing they're going to do is tell us the truth.
Okay.
Remember, the very industry, the nuclear industry, that controls the release of information also virtually controls everything at the Nuclear Regulatory Agency.
Yeah.
The Nuclear Regulatory Agency is not an overseer of the industry. It is a mouthpiece for the industry.
Mm.
Trust nothing that the Nuclear Regulatory Industry says. It has been completely co-opted.
Mm.
More on that in my special investigative report. I do not make this statement in any cavalier manner. I have full documentation and detail to back it up. One more. John from Oak Bridge, you're on the air. I'll take this last call before we go to our guest.
Hi, Gary. Thank you for the great work that you do. I read recently an article on Progressive Radio Network from David Ray Griffin stating that a lot of high-level officials in Washington believe that Bin Laden's been dead since 2002 due to his kidney issues, and it's been possible for him, in the condition that he was in 2001, to survive this long. And when you hear high officials being quoted, like Oliver North and others, it should be credible information for the media to follow up on, and I think it's very sad that they don't. And
they can't afford to. Any reporter in any agency that suggested, that there is some evidence that should be verified and confirmed or reputed that Bin Laden died earlier than this death date. Fine, if you believe that you have evidence to show that those people have no credibility, then bring forth your evidence and discredit them. Otherwise, allow that evidence to come forward and then have it forensically examined. Now, I am working now, and I will not do a report on speculation until such time that I can either confirm or deny the virtue of a particular story. That's why we're very careful about what we say. But I can tell you this, that we are interviewing people who have impeccable credentials within the government who have points of view that vary considerably from what we have currently been told. Only when I'm convinced that the evidence is overwhelming and can withstand any criticism will I bring that forward. Okay?
I look forward to hearing that report.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
I need your love.
To welcome all of you, I'm Gary Nall. My guest, Professor Kurt Spellmeyer, teaches at Rutgers University. He is a director of the school's writing program, and he also received Dharma transmission to be a Zen Roshi and has practiced meditation for over 30 years. And he has written several books, including The Art of Living, Reinventing the Humanities for the 21st Century, and most recently he's written one of the more rare penetrating contemporary spiritual texts introduced by our friend Robert Thurman that actually tackles the social, political, and environmental issues we confront today from a spiritual perspective. Buddha at the Apocalypse, Awakening from a Culture of Destruction. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thank you, Gary. It's wonderful to be here. I'm such an admirer of your program and your career, so I was a little, I was delightfully surprised when I got a call from your program director inviting me on the show. I never imagined I'd be here, so thank you for inviting me.
Well, I appreciate those kind thoughts. We are witnessing a growth among many people in the United States and elsewhere in the world of what we can call apocalyptic thinking, focusing on the imagination of a doomsday scenario that are predestined by some form of divine decree, they claim, and which in turn shapes how people think and act towards domestic events in politics and economics and society and religion, etc. In fact, many of our elected officials are of this mindset and actually vote in the legislature with this thought pattern as its underpinning. In fact, we now more than ever see Congress coagulating thoughts to this. I would like you to first critique for us this apocalyptic mentality. Why is it so prevalent in Western civilization? What are the fundamental causes behind it from a psychological and sociological perspective? And what do you believe are the primary dangers inherent in this kind of mindset?
Well, you know, it is prevalent, and people don't necessarily notice it. But this book had its origins in a trip to the grocery store maybe 6 years ago. I was going to the grocery store, and the woman who was ringing up my groceries had a book next to her that she had been reading when there were no customers, and it was one of the Left Behind books. There's a series of books written by two very powerful conservatives, and Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins, and these are incredibly popular. There's 12 volumes, and they've sold nearly 80 million books. And the fact that this young woman in a grocery store in central New Jersey was avidly reading it and could barely put it down caught my attention. And so I began to research this, and I was really surprised by how powerful this strand of thinking is in American culture and in Western civilization in general. You know, I myself was raised as a Lutheran, you know. So I grew up in a Christian worldview, and then I became interested in Zen, and I began to train in Zen. And I never really thought about this issue of time. You know, why is apocalyptic thinking so powerful? Because Western ways of thinking about time are really the foundation of our civilization. You know, we might look at the conservatives in Congress and the Senate and say those people are religious fanatics and so on and so on. But actually, this doomsday scenario, I think, affects people who are quite secular as well, so that you have people like Jared Diamond writing a book about, in fact, if you Google a word like collapse, or you Google certain keywords, you'll see that book after book after book is written about how we're coming up on a doomsday scenario. And so whether you're religious or secular, there's an underlying paradigm which is very powerful and invisible. It's easy to see explicit beliefs and how they operate. You know, in your work, you do such important work because you show us how power is really, really operating and the kinds of hypocrisies in the system. But what I'm interested in is sort of the invisible subtext or the cultural subtext for so much of what people do. And we might, you know, when people think about say Christianity, they might say, well, Christianity is about love, about caring for your brother, about compassion, and those are all elements of Western religion, of the Judeo-Christian culture. But what makes the Judeo-Christian culture quite extraordinary when you compare it to other cultures in the world is this apocalyptic schema, which affects the very tempo of everyday life. So you have this vision of life, which is really unique. You know, there's a creation, there's a moment of creation, And then all of history is moving towards the moment of absolute destruction, when the whole universe is going to be eliminated and replaced with a different universe. And all evil will be gone. There'll be a general resurrection, and basically the humans who survive will be given deathless bodies. This isn't an exceptional view of theology. This is the mainstream theology that informs Western culture, and it's hugely powerful. So what I think is happening right now is that we're entering a new era of unparalleled uncertainty, complexity. It's very clear that even the smartest people in our culture don't know what to do. And in a way, we're forced to confront the real open-endedness of human life in a way we never have been before. Nobody understands how to solve the problems we're confronting. And so I think that this underlying cultural text, this underlying cultural map, the apocalyptic worldview, which is so central to Western religion and thinking, has become very salient for millions of people. As we're confronting this radical uncertainty, we're turning back to the roots of Western culture. But I think it's a terrible development because, as you say, it's informing political decisions. I mean, there are millions of people who actually hope that the world comes to an end because it's going to resolve our problems, and they're drawing. You know, they aren't heterodox. They aren't marginal. These people are drawing on some of the central traditions of Western culture. If you come from a liberal Christian background, this is a kind of repressed dimension. Liberal Christians, people like the people I went to church with as a kid, didn't teach this worldview. But if you read the Bible, you see how important this view of time is, and it saturates our thinking. So, as we're going through everyday life, we're constantly turning our eyes to the future. The future is the justification for everything we do as a society, as civilization, and as individuals. And so when you look at the resurgence of apocalyptic thinking in our time, it's a real return to the roots of the West, I would say.
I appreciate that in-depth analysis. I'm going to give you an extended overview if you would address it in any way that you feel comfortable, all right?
Sure.
Because what you've called and to mine is a thinking of a self-centered, selfish dream, as it were, which distorts the real lessons that we can learn from history. In fact, it makes history making itself as an illusion. I would say it is a major cause for why we find people denying evidence of global warming, despite all the scientific evidence, and the fact that all nations in the world fully acknowledge it, except for our own. In fact, ecological destruction of the planet then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that only further strengthens the type of apocalyptic thinking individuals that you were referring to. So on the one hand, I'd like for you to expand on this relationship between religion and ecocide, and also the relationship between religion and free market capitalist system, a Randian me first thinking and mentality that ignores the mutual responsibility that we have for each other and our interconnectedness, regardless of whether we are socially wealthy or up the power ladder, down the power ladder. I believe everyone should be invited to the table. Therefore, I will not allow myself, as I've seen so many people on the left, to take everyone in the Tea Party and just integrate them. They haven't gone out to all the Tea Party rallies. I have and met with a lot of very responsible people who, had there been a progressive party, they would have been a part of it. But there was none. There was no other party except the Tea Party, and they were not aligning with left or right or Sarah Palin or some of the other radical rightists, and they didn't. Many libertarians out there don't know where to align themselves. So there are a lot of people who don't know where to align, so we just categorize them out of power altogether. So I'd like for you to talk also about why we are so quick to marginalize people who are not exactly like us, as if they have no value and we shouldn't consider anything they have to say. Then my second point, and this will take us through the end of the program, is there are many individuals, spiritual leaders today in the alternative religious community who are showing the courage to truly critique what is happening in the world from a metaphysical and spiritual perspective, like Rabbi Michael Lerner, Reverend Jim Wallis, Professor Robert Thurman. Those are just a few examples. We've had them all on the show. And I'd like to hear your thoughts why spiritual leaders and thinkers today, although calling themselves progressive, some are so adverse to speaking out against political and economic and social injustices that if the people who call themselves religious took on even the basic principles of the religion, there would be protests by their congregations against corruption, against malfeasance, against self-serving and nihilistic thinking, and we don't see that. Your thoughts, please.
Well, that's quite a question. And all of this is very complicated, and we're not going to settle it in 15 minutes. But I think we're looking in the right places. We do tend to understand the conflicts we're having in these stereotyped ways. So, you know, we look at conservatives, and I would define myself as a progressive. I admire socialism, which has become such a almost a banished idea in the United States today. So it's difficult sometimes not to look at people on the other side or on the other side. And demonize them. And that's one of the reasons in this book that I wanted to get at the cultural dimension. You know, I define myself as a Zen practitioner, as a Buddhist. And Buddhist books are usually books of psychology. They're about how to care for yourself and how to interact with others. They're about consciousness. And they don't always get at this issue of culture, which I think is absolutely crucial. And people with the best intentions and a deep commitment to human well-being will act out of their cultural scripts. And the reason I wrote this book is because this cultural script is so powerful, and it operates, I think, almost invisibly. I mean, when we think about time, we don't think of it as a cultural construction. Our experience of time seems so natural, so self-evident. It's one of the most difficult things, I believe, to understand in a critical way. I have a friend of mine who just came back from Indonesia in Bali, and he said the Balinese have no word for future, and he was astounded. But most cultures don't understand, in history, understood time the way Western people do, in this linear way. And as I said, this operates on the level of whole civilizations. I was listening to your speaking earlier about certain kinds of environmental damage. And the evidence piles up for things like global warming, and people don't respond. And they seem not to be troubled by this. But their reason isn't simply greed, and it isn't simply that they are ill-informed, although sometimes people are greedy and sometimes people are ill-informed. There's a cultural map at work. There's a cultural paradigm. And as the toxins build up in the environment, as the forests get cut down and so on, there are people who look to their cultural traditions, and the cultural traditions say, don't worry, the future is going to be redemptive, it's going to solve all of our problems. You don't have to take responsibility for the present in any way except to be on board with the project of moving forward. So even people who are secular, people who have nothing to do with religion, buy into this linear narrative. In fact, even progressivism has a history of buying into this idea that time has a direction, that it's guaranteed to move towards a better world. This is a kind of providential or divinely ordained fact. And that what we need to do is harmonize ourselves with the forces of change. And I think that's a belief we have to question. The future could turn out to be truly terrible. if we don't take responsibility for the world now. And so, you know, I believe that Buddhism can offer something to the West that's really new, really different. And there's a danger as Buddhism makes a place for itself in the United States and in the West generally, that it's going to lose its critical dimension. It's going to become just the psychology. But I think the most valuable contribution that Buddhism can make is to question this central paradigm or the central myth of the West, which is that we must go forward towards a brighter future and that we don't have to worry about the problems now. You know, if you, this doesn't quite answer your question, but, you know, I've been practicing meditation for 35 years, and I always tell people Buddhist meditation is all about being in the moment. And that basically there's nothing to it except that. I have spent, I don't know, tens of thousands of hours sitting on a meditation cushion, being in the moment. And when you set aside this powerful cultural impulse to go forward in time, to be heading towards apocalypse and heading towards utopia, when you're just resting calmly in the moment, it's deeply, eventually, it may not be at first, but it becomes deeply transformative.
Well, then let's do this. We're out of time for today's show. I'm going to invite you back for part two to talk about what in Buddhism is called no doing, residing always in a calm state of awareness and simply allowing things to unfold, and the pros and cons of that. We'll take this to the next level. We're out of time, however. Professor Kurt Spellmeyer, author of a very important work, and it is called Buddha at the Apocalypse, Awakening from a Culture of Destruction. We all know and recognize that we are in a culture of destruction. We also know that the current paradigm will not change on its own. There's too much need and greed, too much insecurity and fighting for power from all different sides, but it leaves out of the equation all the people who could inject themselves and demand change now. Start making positive changes today, and we can do that, and that will be part two of our discussion. Thank you very much, sir, for being with us. I look forward to our next conversation in the very near future. I'll see you back here shortly. Have a nice day.
Whoa, 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 whoa.